Hey, good morning. This is a date and time set for argument in this matter. I'll call up the first case, 79180 Chicago Title of Nevada v. Charter Holdings, Inc. And Ms. Lehman, are you prepared to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
I just want to make sure. I don't see Justice Stiglitz, but Julie, you said she is on?
I'm on, Justice Perry-Gary.
Okay, fine. And Justice Silver, I see you there in the Las Vegas courtroom. Okay. Ms. Lehman, would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay. All right. You may proceed.
May it please the court. Natalie Lehman for Appellants United Title of Nevada and its successor in interest, Chicago Title of Nevada. This is a case that started out with a simple request from MoneySource involving one deed of trust, one lot, one reconveyance, which became a lawsuit by MoneySource for one cause of action against respondent chartered pension plan only, seeking declaratory relief and no money damages. After the dispute with MoneySource was resolved and the deed of trust reconveyed, Charter churned this into a case against Chicago involving 50 additional lots, a revived defunct entity that was never sued, Chartered Realty, and a 5-day trial to prove up a handshake escrow agreement, ultimately ending up in a judgment against Chicago for nearly $400,000, most of which are attorney's fees.
Well, Ms. Lehman, you're detailing a very protracted set of facts, but in 2013, your United Title or Chicago Title, when they were notified that there was an encumbrance on a lot, a mere phone call to the title company, you guys released that cloud. So couldn't it, obviously Justice Gonzalez or Judge Gonzalez thought the same thing.
Well, Your Honor,
why is it that you could do that in 2013 based on a phone call and take off the encumbrance, yet you couldn't do it in whatever year that you went to trial?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the email exchange in 2013 was distinguishable. In that situation, Mr. Ritter's communications were clear and cooperative, stating that he had authority to sign on behalf of Chartered Pension. And most importantly, although Chicago prepared the documents, they did not sign it or record it in their capacity as a trustee. Instead, Chartered Pension Plan substituted itself as trustee in that instrument, and Mr. Ward Ritter signed on behalf of Chartered both as beneficiary and as trustee. And this document's at the respondent's appendix at page 455.
So why couldn't you do the same protocol that you did in 2013 for the lots here? Because your company was the exclusive escrow agent for all of these lots.
Well, there was a statutory duty on behalf of Chartered as the beneficiary to execute a request for reconveyance. In this situation, the emails that the court looked at in 2017, they were not clear. They did not ask Chicago to execute a reconveyance. They did not say that the deed of trust had been paid off. Instead, they threatened litigation. They were asking for coverage under a non-existent title policy of insurance. It was a very different situation than in 2013.
Well, how did they figure out? I mean, obviously they got notified on the one deed. Did they go back over then and find that you left encumbrances on 51 of the lots? I mean, wasn't the title company paid to do all this in escrow? The company got paid to do this.
Well, in the trial, Mr. Ritter testified that their agreement was that he had testified that they needed to execute a written request for reconveyance, which is also under paragraph 9 of the deed of trust. But importantly, that the course of dealing of the parties showed that rather than United executing these reconveyances without instruction from Chartered, rather Chartered on 5 separate occasions executed their own reconveyances, substituted themselves as trustee, and released, because under the statute 107.078, there is a predicate duty on behalf of Chartered to do a written request for reconveyance. Now, because a trustee would not have the information of whether a loan was satisfied or not, and here Chartered was both the beneficiary and the borrower under the deed of trust. So they would know when the deed of trust was satisfied, and their statutory duty would be invoked, and they would have to do a request for reconveyance.
Now, so, Ms. Lehman, how is it that you, I mean, what was testified to at this bench trial was that the title company was the one that had exclusive control over all the policies and protocols of how escrow would be handled and how all of this would be handled. Is it your position then that because you made these policies that you somehow avoid liability under the statute just based on your internal policies? Because that's what it seems like to me. It looks like you decide how it's going to go back in 1998 or whenever this development. You make money from each one of these lots. You close the lots. You give these lots as marketable title. And now, years later, when all of these clouds are found on each one of these 51 parcels, you're now putting up the statute as some kind of shield from liability. When your company decided exclusive protocols of escrow in this case.
Well, Your Honor, there was not a written agreement. This was a handshake agreement. So the testimony that was at the trial was all circumstantial evidence regarding other transactions.
But the court can decide based on all of your cookie cutter title policy or whatever, the title escrow documents. That owner had all of the other documents that they had used from other developments. And they're the same ones, and your people testify they're the same cookie cutter, you know, escrow instructions that are used in all of these developments.
Why can't
Judge Gonzalez use these as circumstantial evidence to find that you violated the statute here as well, using your own policies?
Well, Judge Gonzalez found that there was a course of dealing, and under the Right Way case, a course of dealing cannot circumvent statutory obligations. And under subsection 3 of the statute, a trustee is not empowered to act, and its obligations are not triggered unless and until it receives a properly executed request for reconveyance. Because while a trustee or escrowee will know if a payoff is made, they don't have access to the records to know if that payment was applied to the loan and paid off. Only a loan.
Well, you closed. All of these deals were closed, right? All of these closed, and title was passed to the buyers, right?
Correct.
Okay, how'd you do that? How did that happen if, in fact, the developer didn't send you over whatever, by a phone call, whatever, to say that it was paid? How did these close? You're saying that they didn't do it back in the day, but all of these closed and title passed.
Mr. Ritter testified at page 219 of the record that his agreement with United Title required a written request for reconveyance. And he testified at page 268 of the record, he did not recall ever executing one of these requests for reconveyances. And the history of the parties shows that in at least five other deeds of trust in the same development, Chartered chose to exit, to substitute themselves as trustee and reconvey those deed of trusts in full rather than partially lot per lot. So that's what the evidence showed at trial, was that's how the parties proceeded. And in fact, Chartered could have recorded a reconveyance at any time because 107.0284 empowers them to substitute themselves. And these reconveyance I mentioned were admitted as trial exhibits double S, double T, quadruple U, and quadruple W. Chicago couldn't breach this statute because it never received a proper request for reconveyance.
What do you make of the respondent's brief when they cite to 107.079, subsection 7, where it says this section shall not be deemed to create an exclusive procedure for the reconveyance of a deed of trust and the issuance of blah, blah, blah. Because they say that, obviously, that what is in the prior statute that you're relying on, it's not the exclusive procedure based on the next statute.
In that same statute, it says that this section shall not affect any other procedures, whether or not such procedures are set forth in the statute or the reconveyance. So that means that this 107.079 does not relieve Chartered of its statutory obligations to deliver a request for reconveyance. It doesn't relieve them of that duty that they have, which is a predicate to a trustee being required to record a reconveyance.
How did you close all these lots if it wasn't done? I mean, circumstantially, it would show that they obviously followed the statute at the time, circumstantially.
There was also evidence at the trial of a substantial gap period of time. There was a problem with the county recorder's office in which during the time that the deed of trust was recorded and the different lots were being sold out, that the deed of trust was not pulling up on title for whatever reason. And this particular deed of trust did not go through the escrow process with Chicago. It was recorded as an accommodation, but it was prepared by Chartered's attorney, Jones Vargas, and there was no escrow. That's what the testimony was, that if it's stamped as an accommodation, it wasn't handled through an escrow process with Chicago. The lower court also erred in finding that the discovery rule applied because the Chartered as lender and borrower under the deed of trust had all the information it needed to discover its claims as of 2001. A plaintiff must use diligence in determining the existence of a cause of action, and mere ignorance as to reasonably accessible information will not delay or stop accrual of a discovery-based statute of limitation. The record is silent regarding any diligence exercised by Chartered in the 15 years after the deed of trust was paid off. The fact that Chartered had independently executed its own substitutions and reconveyances in the same development acknowledges this duty. If Chartered couldn't find a copy of the reconveyance in its own files, they could have searched the public records at any time to determine whether a reconveyance had been recorded. The lower court also erred in finding that Chartered was entitled to equitable indemnity because it did not include in its analysis the court's own findings that Chartered committed independent wrongs. At paragraphs 60 and 61 of page 983 of the record, the court's findings demonstrate Chartered's utter failure to mitigate damages or cooperate with MoneySource in good faith. Chartered had the control and the ability to avoid litigation completely multiple times. This is evident in its legal strategy, where Chartered took a claim of a potential statutory damages of $1,000 and inflated it to more than $400,000 mostly attorney's fees. This is more than the original deed of trust, which was $290,000. Highlighting the disparity between the intentional misconduct of Chartered and the mere inadvertence of Chicago, at findings of fact 64, page 984, the court found that the genesis of the entire lawsuit was a combination of Ms. Engelman's failure to put two and two together and Mr. Ritter's refusal to convey the deed of trust without reimbursement of his attorney's fees. And lastly, the lower court erred in awarding attorney's fees and costs because they were not pled or proved at trial as special damages, which is required under this court's holding in Sandy Valley. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Lehman, you've basically exhausted all but 6 seconds of your rebuttal. But since there was a number of questions during your rebuttal time, I'll give you two additional minutes for rebuttal, and I'll offer Mr. Barnett the same additional 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Barnett.
Thank you, Justices. May it please the court. In this transaction for this development, Chicago Title's predecessor, United Title, wore three hats. They wore the hat of the escrowee. They wore the hat of the trustee. They wore the hat of the title company issuing the title policy. Under all three of those hats, they were charged with the duty to carry out their obligations as agreed to among the parties for the sale out of over 609 lots in this Spring Valley Ranch development. What occurred during the course of these sellouts was well testified to at the trial. Chicago Title's own employees testified that the customary practices and procedures that were implemented in the sellout were those customarily used throughout the valley, and in particular, those same type of custom practices and procedures that United Title had undertaken with Chartered on other transactions in addition to the sellout of this development. Now, Mr. Ritter did testify at trial that he did deliver the releases and reconveyances per United Title's instructions. Judge Gonzalez astutely ascertained that this occurred. He ruled so very clearly in the findings of fact and conclusions of law in paragraph 37. This therefore takes out any type of argument pertaining to 107.0773 and whether or not the releases and reconveyances were delivered at the time of closing. Judge Gonzalez continued in her rationale and in her ruling in finding that because of these agreements, should there have been any oversight on the side of Chicago, of Mr. Ritter and Chartered Holdings, it therefore must have been incumbent upon the escrowee, the trustee, and the title company, all of whom were the same company, to resolve those problems. Indeed, Chartered relied upon the expertise of Chicago Title in order to carry out the transactions for the 609-lot sellout. What we see is, in the beginning, we were notified in 2016, and that's a point of clarification, because just as in 2013, where the 1197 deed of trust was released by Chicago Title with nary a request from a third-party attorney saying, hey, I need this deed of trust released, Chicago Title then took it upon themselves to reach out to Mr. Ritter, who at the time said, certainly, I'd be happy to help. What do you need from me? And Chicago Title prepared the substitution and release and reconveyance that Mr. Ritter then executed to release the 1197 deed of trust without incident. Now, fast forward, same development, 2016, Ms. Portia Vesley from Vantage Title in Florida, again, trying to clear title on Ms. Lai's property, the first property that brought this to Chartered's attention with regard to the 1717 deed of trust being unreleased. So Mr. Ritter reaches out, is contacted by Portia Vesely. He says, you know, talk to Lisa Engelman over at Chicago Title. She's handled this for me before. Ms. Vesely reaches out to Chicago Title and is subsequently told, no, we can't help you. All the while, facts adduced during the trial testimony demonstrate that Chicago Title knew at the time in 2016 and again in 2017 when Chartered reached out to them that the 1717 deed of trust had not been released. Indeed, United Title knew that they had reinsured over the 1717 deed of trust multiple times since the recordation and the ultimate discovery of their failure again in 2016. So it was United Title's refusal in 2016 that first caused the impetus for this lawsuit. That was their second chance to do right.
Mr. Barnett, let me ask you a question in that regard. My understanding is United Title basically indicated they explained they'd first need a deed of trust and request a reconveyance from Charter. Is that correct? Chartered Pension?
Yes, Your Honor. Are you referring to the 2000?
Yes, yes. And then a couple months later, Money Source contacted Mr. Ritter to request that the pension, in fact, reconvey the deed of trust, right?
It did. And we again directed them to Chicago Title.
Well, and then actually what happened, didn't Mr. Ritter, he actually looked for counsel and then requested $2,500 in fees in order to reconvey the deed of trust, and he expected that he'd incur $2,500 in legal fees to accomplish this. TMSI offered only $500, and so then they brought a quiet title action, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So it seems to me this could have been nipped in the bud on both sides right at that point. And so this kind of ended up a matter of principle on both sides, didn't it?
I don't believe it was a matter of principle, Your Honor, as much as it is a matter of enforcing the agreements that were in place in 1998 when this development was put into sellout.
Couldn't it have been nipped in the bud way back then had either TMSI ponied up $2,500 or Mr. Ritter just kind of conceded the fact, okay, I'll get the reconveyance. This would never have happened.
But there was also another defendant, Patrick Patterson, who was not locatable at the time. So although Mr. Ritter was willing with the $2,500 payment to go ahead and release the deed of trust, that did not occur. What happened after that is I reached out to Chicago Title asking them for assistance again. And I was again told, no, you have no claims here, irregardless of the fact that they were the escrowee throughout the transactions. And in that instance, we were attempting to enforce those agreements that were in place, that we had agreed to, and we relied upon during the sale-out process. Then what happened during the course of discovery, it was ascertained that not one, but 52 lots had not been released from that 1717 deed of trust. The impetus for the addition of Chartered Realty was that it was a necessary party under both NRCP 13 and NRCP 19. And the court properly adduced that complete relief could not be afforded without the presence of Chartered Realty. Chartered Realty was the developer. Chartered Pension was one of the lenders. They too shared a common ownership in Chartered Development and Mr. Ritter. Nevertheless, when we ascertained that that none of the lots had been released except and save for one, which was Mr. Patterson's lot, that had been released 18 months after that lot had closed. So in each and every instance for these 52 lots, United Title didn't do its job. They didn't release They were provided releases and reconveyances at the time, partial releases and reconveyances, and that's consistent with the 1717 dot and its rider that provided for partial releases and quite common in this type of a development. Then again, we were asked in 2016 to release the deed of trust. And they were told no. And mind you, not only were they told no, Mr. Vesely, but she was told to go talk to another insurer who had insured over that deed of trust. So it was well known to Chicago Title that the 1717 deed of trust was out there and existed. Carter didn't know about it until 2016. Vesely brought it to their attention. And what's important here insofar as the type of behavior that occurred and as it applies to both mitigation as well as a statute of limitations, all the while, for the entire 20 years, United Title, its successor Chicago Title, continued to reinsure over that 1717 deed of trust, all the while knowing that it was still out there. Not once in that 20-year intervening period did they reach out to Mr. Ritter. Not once during that 20-year intervening period they rely upon 107.077 subsections 4 and 5's provisions that allow the trustee to act for themselves when they know that the payment had been made on the underlying loan. And what's important with this is Chicago Title keeps attempting to shift the focus on the fact that they had access to all information, indeed more information than Charter did. They were the escrowee. They knew when the deals were going to close. They were charged under the escrow agreement as it integrated with the purchase and sale agreement to deliver good, marketable title at closing. And this didn't happen. They even went so far as to remove the 1717 deed of trust on the CLTA and ALTA policies that were issued for the lie transaction. So what happens here is Chicago Title knows full well for over 20 years that they had the obligation under both the escrow agreements, the purchase and sale agreement, trustees agreement, and their statutory obligations to release those if they knew that it was paid off. And in this instance, they would have to have necessarily known it was paid off in order to close the transactions. It was part and parcel of their policy and procedure. It's frankly part and parcel of every escrowee's policy and procedure is to follow the written instructions and to release all documents necessary. Mm-hmm. The court in Allen really noted that this type of an oversight was actionable because it is the duty of the escrowee to release and record all documents necessary to convey the nature and type of title here, good, marketable, and title to the purchaser.
Mr. Barnett, can I interrupt you? I hate to interrupt you, but I want to get to a couple points. The one point I want to address is the statute 107.078 subsection 3. Why did United Title have any duty to record a reconveyance under that statute? The statute clearly indicates they don't have that obligation until a beneficiary requests a reconveyance.
Well, in this instance, the beneficiary did request a reconveyance at the time of each closing. Okay. So that portion is satisfied. But I would like to turn Your Honor's attention to 107.077, 4, and 5, which do provide that the title, that the trustee has the duty to release when they know that it's been paid off. And there, you know,
is that under a full, let's see. This is a partial discharge we're talking about rather than a full discharge, right?
Well, for parts of it, it was a partial discharge. But ultimately, in the end, when they knew that the entire development had been sold out, it would have become a complete release and reconveyance.
But at the time, it was a partial under 078, right?
Well, during the sale out, yes, Your Honor, it was. But once that sale out had concluded, then necessarily it would have been a release of that deed of trust in totality. So a full reconveyance. And so it's not a distinction without form, because throughout the sale out process, United Title had that obligation to do the partial releases. Upon conclusion of the sale out, for which they served as the sole escrowee and provided all of the services and had all of the documents and knowledge as to whether or not it was paid off or not, at that point in time, it would have been incumbent upon United Title to do the proper thing, which is to clean up what they were obligated to do upon conclusion of the development. And one might say that that cleanup slipped through the cracks. But that's the type of detail that Chartered was relying upon from United Title to assure that they delivered good marketable title to each of its buyers. And that unfortunately did not happen. With regard to the statute of limitations, as I mentioned previously, Chart was unaware of the unreleased 1717 deed of trust until June of 2016 when Ms. Portia Bestley brought it to their attention. Upon ascertaining that, they undertook the same actions that they undertook to release the 1197 deed of trust back in 2013, which was to request assistance from Chicago Title. So, and the court very clearly ruled that they didn't, that Chartered did not ascertain until 2016. And when coupled with the actions of United Title and Chicago Title and their obfuscation of the existence of the unreleased 1717 deed of trust, we clearly satisfy each of the prongs required in order to take advantage of the discovery rule.
Mr. Barnett, what do you make of their Sandy Valley argument regarding attorney's fees? I did review the reviewed the answer and the third party complaint, and attorney's fees was pleaded. But what do you have to say about their argument that it wasn't, quote, proven at trial?
It was proven at trial. The record indicates that Mr. Ritter testified that he had incurred attorney's fees and costs. Those attorney's fees and costs, upon the judge's ascertainment and grant of judgment in Chartered's favor, held that the reasonableness of and the amounts of those fees and costs were to be ascertained at a post-trial hearing on specifically held for attorney's fees and costs. One other important note is that the billing summaries up until trial were produced to the opposing counsel, so they were well aware of the impending fees that were coming their way. And so as such, I believe Sandy Valley has been satisfied. Chartered is indeed one of those third parties that was compelled to bring litigation in order to gain satisfaction based on United Title's and Chicago Title's failures and obfuscations of their unreleased 1717 deed of trust.
Mr. Barnett, let me just ask you something in that regard. How does that comport with Pardee, the case that came out right after this?
Well, I believe we addressed the Pardee holding in our briefing, and
isn't it contrary?
No, I don't believe that it is contrary to that ruling, because in Pardee, it did nothing to abrogate or overrule Sandy Valley, but rather in ruling in terms of attorney's fees as special damages, that is appropriate under Pardee because Charter became involved in a third party legal dispute as a result of the breach.
And again, you've run out of time, but I'm going to have you finish up your response to this, just in the sense that you prove up your damages at trial as opposed to some post-trial motion.
Well, the damages were proven up at trial in the sense that the attorney's fees were incurred and were necessarily related to that action. The amount of those attorney's fees and costs, those were the only items that were adduced and attended to at the post-trial hearing.
But at trial, the amounts were not proven up at trial. That was a post-trial proceeding, the amounts.
The amounts were a post-trial proceeding. The damages were proven at trial through testimony.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ron.
Let's see. I believe the time she's got left should be 2:06. Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start with the Sandy Valley issue. The district court acknowledged during a 52C motion brought by Chicago It's on page 708 of the record, that the only evidence of damages that was presented at trial was the $2,500 that Mr. Ritter claimed as attorney's fees in his demands to Money Source. And when Chartered's counsel inquired about proffering invoices, the court reminded him that his evidence was closed. And when he tried to explain that he understood that this evidence of damages could be presented after the close of trial, the court chided him, quote, "That's not what Sandy Valley says." So the court was, lower court was initially on the right track on Sandy Valley. Now, regarding the emails from 2017 from Chartered to Chicago, the court found that those two requests did not actually ask for assistance with releasing the deed of trust. The email from Chartered's counsel to Ms. Engelman was on findings of fact 65, page 984, and the court found that the email threatened litigation and demanded coverage pursuant to a title policy of insurance, and that the email did not state that Chartered pension plan was paid in full, and it did not ask her to release the deed of trust. Similarly, in the email from Mr. Ritter to Michelle George of Chicago, and that's findings of fact 74, page 985 of the record, that Mr. Ritter just asked Ms. George for help with unraveling these mysteries as to why the reconveyance had not been recorded. If this court does not reverse these findings, they would set a dangerous precedent where beneficiaries of deeds of trust would be not upholding their statutory duties to execute a request for reconveyance. And I would ask that this court overturn and reverse all of the holdings of the lower court. Thank you.
Okay, counsel, thank you for the excellent briefing in this case. We appreciate your time to be here and argue this matter for us today. And this case will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until 11 o'clock.